The views expressed on Science for the People are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
This week on Science for the People, we're looking at how science might have influenced the work of the greatest writer in English. Welcome to Science for the People. I'm Rochelle Saunders. With me is science journalist and broadcaster Dan Falk. He's written for Smithsonian, New Scientist, Astronomy, Sky and Telescope, The Walrus, The Globe and Mail, and many other publications. And he was a 2011 Knight Science Journalism Fellow at MIT. He's no stranger to radio, having been a regular contributor to Ideas on CBC Radio, and has won several international awards for his radio documentaries. He's previously written two popular science books, In Search of Time and Universe on a T-Shirt. He's here today to talk about his newest book, The Science of Shakespeare, A New Look at the Playwright's Universe. Welcome to the show, Dan.
Hi, Rochelle. Thanks very much for having me.
Okay, so why Shakespeare and science? Where did you find that connection?
You know, it's interesting. I think we might intuitively know that Shakespeare lived at this time when all these things were going on, things that, you know, in retrospect, looking back, we say, all right, this was the beginning period of the scientific revolution. But we don't really say much beyond that, usually. You know, if you take a Shakespeare class in high school or university, I mean, of course, you'll get some context about Queen Elizabeth or, you know, some of the battles that were being fought, some of the political problems. There's always a little chapter on Elizabethan theater and what other writers and playwrights were doing at that time. But that's about it. You know, people try to put Shakespeare in context, but the biographies that I've been reading of Shakespeare and other books from that period just kind of don't say very much about this this interesting fact that this was the beginning of the scientific revolution. And so that was my beginning point. You know, maybe there's something to, you know, is there something to be said about, you know, where Shakespeare fits in this really intriguing period of history?
And the period of history really is fascinating from a scientific perspective. I mean, there was a lot going on here.
There really was. Yeah, we might want to keep in mind that even 20 years before Shakespeare was born, Copernicus had published his revolutionary theory, putting the sun rather than the earth at the sort of the center of the system of the world. Now, it's not that that was exactly hot news, and there wasn't Twitter and all that, so only, you know, a few people thought it was really interesting, and plus it was a highly mathematical, highly technical work. But nonetheless, it was slowly making the rounds. At the same time that Copernicus published his book, Vesalius published the first sort of modern anatomy textbook, correcting some of the errors of the ancient Greeks. Actually, that's something both books have in common. This was a period when people were just beginning to see that not everything the ancient Greeks had said was actually right. So there were sort of new investigations that were just beginning. And one really interesting point of trivia is that Galileo and Shakespeare were actually born in the same year. So they were exact contemporaries. They never met. Galileo outlived Shakespeare. Not that the very end part of Galileo's life was particularly happy, but at any rate, he did stick around on this planet longer than Shakespeare did. So that's interesting too. Yeah, as you say, there really was a lot going on. It was a time of tremendous change.
Shakespeare himself is a really intriguing historical figure as well, in part because we know very little about him as the person. He seems to have left us a lot of plays, but not a lot else.
Yeah, and now the fact that there isn't that much to sink your teeth into in terms of sort of biographical information, unfortunately, plays into the hands of conspiracy theorists and other people who want to, you know, present some kind of alternative history. But the thing, and I've talked to Shakespeare scholars and experts about this, what we have about Shakespeare's life is actually pretty good, all things considered. He wasn't a nobleman, you know, he wasn't rich, and he certainly wasn't a king. So given that, you don't really expect there to be a lot of personal effects or letters. I mean, now it would be nice if we had some personal letters, because presumably he wrote and received some letters over the course of his life, given that he was a writer, but we just don't have anything like that. You know, by way of contrast, we know a fair bit more about Marlowe. Now, Marlowe lived at around the same time But Marlowe had this very complicated life because he was a government spy and likely a double agent. And, you know, he was faced with all kinds of accusations of atheism, and he was a homosexual in a time when that was not considered very, very acceptable. So these things were kind of provocative. So Marlowe rocked the boat quite a bit. So you can see why people were sort of keeping tabs on him and saying things about him. So compared to that, you know, Shakespeare's life is a bit more of a blank. But, you know, we have when he was baptized, we have his record of his marriage, of his three children, one of whom died fairly young. That was the son Hamnet, not to be confused with Hamlet, but there may be something to say about those two names. And we have, well, let's see, we have his death, but we don't know what killed him. And we have some of his legal and real estate dealings that all seem, again, these seem kind of minor and dull and not much to sink your teeth into if you were writing a biography. Obviously, that's not what my book is, but that's exactly right. There's a lot of sort of gaps in the story of Shakespeare's life. So that's tricky, and it means there is a lot of work to be done. But it's absolutely true that he did leave us, you know, this rather vast array of written works, and so we have that. We have his, you know, his published works. Now, these are dramatic works, and a couple of poems, and the sonnets, and that of course leaves you with the question of, well, you know, there's stuff in the plays. There are people who hold certain beliefs, but are these Shakespeare's own beliefs? And of course, we don't know the answer to that. About as far as you can go is you can say that if Shakespeare's characters are aware of, you know, something, well, then Shakespeare must have been aware of it too. But if his characters say they're for or against something, well, that doesn't really tell you if Shakespeare was for or against it.
So the other thing we should just probably mention before we get too into this is there's a lot of speculation that's going on here, but that's kind of part of the fun.
Yeah, I mean, it is. So, you know, here I've said that the lack of biographical information on Shakespeare plays into the hands of people who want to present highly speculative alternative histories and that sort of thing. And then in my own book, I go ahead and speculate quite a lot, but I don't speculate about the so-called authorship problem. I'm speculating about something else. Yeah. So that's true. I guess I am quite open to speculation, as long as it's done carefully, as long as we don't get carried away with ourselves. And something I do try to do in the book is to help the reader distinguish between what's, you know, plausible and what is a bit more out into left field. But if you notice, even in the, you know, the most well-respected biographies of Shakespeare, and I'm just looking behind me at my shelf, and, you know, the books by Stephen Greenblatt, Frank Kermode, there's a whole bunch that are very popular, but there you always get into a little bit of speculation just because, you know, we have facts about the time period and we have facts about people that Shakespeare would have encountered, but eventually you have to say probably Shakespeare did this, or we can imagine Shakespeare did that. So if you're actually, once you start looking for those caveats, you actually find it in all of the, you know, the writing about Shakespeare.
One of my favorite things about your book, actually, is how upfront you are about the speculation that's in it. You're very clear where it is, what types it is, why it needs to be there, and like you said, the scale of plausible to way left wing.
Yeah, I'm not trying to fool anyone here, and especially some of the, you know, I'm a journalist, and some of the researchers that I spoke with, you know, have their own ideas about what, you know, Shakespeare's thought processes and his beliefs. And some of those, and later we can talk about Peter Usher if we get to that point, you know, he's done quite a lot of writing himself on this subject, Shakespeare and Science, and reached what I think are somewhat extravagant conclusions. But nonetheless, there's a lot of sort of reasonable arguments that have been presented as well. And yeah, so I do try to help the reader kind of distinguish. For example, Donald Olson, a professor in Texas, has written extensively on Shakespeare and astronomy, the play Hamlet in particular, and astronomy. I have a whole chapter on Hamlet, and I actually found Olson's ideas to be pretty compelling. So yeah, so I do try to just kind of give the reader the information that they need to kind of digest the stuff, like what's plausible and what's a little bit further out on the fringe.
You're listening to Science for the People. I'm Rochelle Saunders, and I'm here with Dan Falk, science journalist, broadcaster, and author of the new book, The Science of Shakespeare, A New Look at the Playwright's Universe. Okay, so let's talk about Copernicus, because his heliocentric theory came out around this time or just before this time, and there's a lot of ideas around Shakespeare and the heliocentric view of the world.
Yeah, now the tricky thing is that people have examined Shakespeare's plays, as you might imagine, looking for some kind of endorsement or rejection or something about the heliocentric theory, because after all, again, as I mentioned before, you know, looking back as historians or historians of science, we think, oh my goodness, the Copernican Revolution, it was this really big deal. So, you know, Shakespeare must have had something to say about it, right? And it's actually hard to find any overt discussion of it. There's a about the closest you get is this famous passage in Troilus and Cressida, where Ulysses, one of the generals, is giving a speech. It's sometimes called the degree speech, and he's talking about how carefully put together the universe is, and he's talking about the planets, and he's comparing it to hierarchical political systems on Earth, and he's basically, it's a very, the idea was actually quite well entrenched in Shakespeare's time. He's talking about this idea that if there are disturbances, you know, political disturbances, it would be as upsetting as if someone moved the planets around. You know, planets are in their place for a reason, so let's all try to, you know where we ought to be, and let's all try to understand the proper order of things.
The heavens themselves, the planets, and this center observe degree, priority, and place, insistiture, course, proportion, season, form, office, and custom in all line of order. And therefore is the glorious planet soul in noble eminence enthroned and sphered amidst the other, whose medicinable eye corrects the ill aspects of planet's evil, and posts, like the commandment of a king, sans check to good and bad. But when the planets in evil mixture to disorder wander, what plagues and what portents, what mutiny, what raging of the sea, shaking of the earth, commotion in the winds, frights, changes, horrors, divert and crack, rend and deracinate the unity and married calm of states, quite from their fixture.
The problem is it's a little bit ambiguous. I mean, it mentions the noble sun sort of enthroned in his sphere. It mentions, so this reference to spheres, which crops up quite a bit, could sound actually very medieval, because the medieval view had the planets attached to these so-called crystalline spheres or heavenly spheres, and almost everybody believed this right up until the time of Tycho Brahe, a Danish astronomer, and he was not quite ready to embrace Copernicus, but he rejected the Greek view eventually and figured out that these spheres don't really exist, and that's, of course, obviously how we see things today. But the Ulysses speech can sort of go either way. By treating the sun as a very noble entity, you could sort of argue that it's an endorsement, maybe, of the Copernican system. So you see how tricky this is, right? There isn't any passage in anywhere in the canon that kind of obviously says, you know, yay Copernicus or boo Copernicus. So that's kind of where that's sat for quite a long time. And so I had to, you know, dig a little bit deeper, and that's where we get, is there something in Cymbeline about Galileo, or is there something in Hamlet about, you know, the supernova 1572? So that's where the story begins, I guess.
I was going to head right into Hamlet, because that is an interesting part of your book that you talk about. So why don't you dive right into Hamlet?
Sure. Well, of course, it's perhaps Shakespeare's most famous play, maybe his greatest, maybe the greatest work in English literature. We can let the critics debate that. So there are a few things that are quite interesting, and one that stood out for me in terms of recent scholarship, and this is the work of Donald Olson, who I mentioned a bit earlier. He looks at, I think it's Act 1, Scene 1. It's very near the beginning of the play, where, if you'll remember, the guards are standing watch on the battlements at Elsinore. It's a frosty evening, and there's a ghostly figure that appears. As it turns out, it's a sort of a ghost that looks very much like the dead king. Eventually, Hamlet will encounter the ghost himself, obviously. Before that, Horatio is chatting with the guards, and he's, you know, he's skeptical. Horatio is the scholar. According to the play, both Hamlet and Horatio have been studying at Wittenberg. There's more we can say about that. But at any rate, Horatio asks the guards, well, so this ghost has been appearing every night, you say, well, when does he appear? And one of the guards points up to the sky and says, well, when that same star that's now westward from the pole, he said, you know, when the star shows up in that spot where you see it just now, that's where the ghost usually appears. And in fact, the sentence is cut off in the middle because just then the ghost comes back and there's a whole thing. And that's where Horatio confronts the ghost for the first time. And as I say, of course, later Hamlet will confront the ghost. Now, what is this star westward from the pole? Different Shakespeare scholars have tried to sort of analyze this, and to their credit, this is a case where people have tried to invoke you know, what we know about astronomy and physics to try to work through it. The only problem is, I think they've come to the wrong conclusion, and if you go through, again, you know, you can pick all kinds of very, very good scholarly editions of the play, and you'll get a little footnote explaining that the pole refers to the pole star, meaning the North Star or Polaris. Well, that's fine. I don't think anybody was going to guess something else. I mean, that part's good. Well, what was this object westward from the pole? And you see guesses like, well, maybe it was a planet, or, well, maybe it was the bright star Capella. For those of your listeners who know their way around the night sky, Capella is a very bright star, sort of among the winter constellations. Well, those are actually not very good guesses because the geometry just doesn't work out. And Donald Olson sort of had an article about 10 years ago where he sort of talks you through it. And there just isn't anything in the right. He sort of explains why we think they were watching in November and why it was, we think it was 1 o'clock in the morning. Now, actually, why we think it was 1 o'clock in the morning was because it's given to us in the text of the play. One of the characters says, when the bell beats one. So, Olson has sort of pieced it together and says, well, the part of the sky that's being referenced here is around the constellation Cassiopeia. There's nothing really that leaps out from the constellation Cassiopeia. It has sort of five stars that make a W or an M. So it's fairly easy to spot it in the northern sky, except all five of the stars are kind of the same brightness as each other, and they're not that bright. They're so-called second magnitude stars. So Olson has sort of played around with this and offered something a bit different, but I think reasonably convincing, or at least very, very interesting. And he points out that there was a new star, what we now call a supernova, that sort of blazed forth in the sky in November of 1572. And this was a very important event in the history of astronomy, because it was observed by Tycho Brahe in Denmark, and we actually now call this object Tycho's star. And it led him to ponder, you know, the nature of the heavenly spheres, how objects moved, whether the heavens were actually immutable or not. And it really pushed him along to turn his back on the established medieval view of the heavens and look at alternative ideas. So 1572, Shakespeare was just a young lad, 8 years old. I mean, you can say, well, you know, he was only 8 years old. It probably wouldn't have made much of an impression of him. Well, maybe, maybe not. I mean, we have to remember the night sky was kind of a big deal back then. There was no light pollution, or at least none to speak of. There would have been none in the part of Warwickshire where Shakespeare was growing up. And there were no distractions from the internet or television. There were clouds, because this is England. It rained a lot, and it might have been snowing even. But if the sky was clear and you looked up, you would have been blown away by the stars, the Milky Way, all of those things that, you know, sadly, now you have to drive many hours into the countryside to enjoy. So there's that. And also, the supernova was described in a book published between 10 and 20 years later. Holinshed publishes his Chronicles and talks about the appearance of this star and how significant it was. And we know Shakespeare read Holinshed's Chronicles because he's sort of cribbing from it in various of his history plays. So we know it's a book that Shakespeare was reading. So was he inspired to use this object in the opening scene of Hamlet? It's not quite a proof, but I think it's Donald Olson's paper presents, I think, a quite interesting argument for a different interpretation of what the star westward from the pole is. So what about this Danish astronomer Tycho Brahe? Well, Shakespeare never visited Denmark. In fact, Shakespeare never visited England, so far as we know. But some of the actors that he was friends with did go there and, in fact, performed at court in Elsinore. So that's kind of cool. I should mention that Elsinore, so it's a real place. It's a castle on the coast of Denmark. And Tycho Brahe was a nobleman and decided to become an astronomer. And he was friends with the king. And he said to the king of Denmark, look, I need a place to do my observations. And the king said, okay, I'm going to give you this island. It's the island of Vien, which is located between Denmark and Sweden. Actually, at this time, it was all part of the Danish kingdom. So Tycho goes to do his observations for many years, actually, on this little island. The island is actually just a few miles from Elsinore, so they're within line of sight of each other. And even King James, when he visited Denmark, dropped in to visit Tycho Brahe. So Tycho is actually almost a celebrity of sorts among scientists. I don't know, like the Stephen Hawking of today or something like that. It's not a great analogy, but it's quite interesting. And lastly, there's a very well-known engraving of Tycho Brahe that he included when he published some of his astronomical observations in, I think, the 1590s. And he sent these around. He was really, you know, he was a big name, but he was very pompous too. And he wanted to be recognized for his accomplishments. So he was sending around published observations to different colleagues, including people that he knew in England. And he includes on the front of this, I guess you could call it a book, a little book of astronomy observations, an engraving, a copperplate engraving that he had done up in Amsterdam, showing himself in the middle, dressed in his full, nobleman's attire and looking very grand. But then if you look around the outer perimeter of it, and it's, of course, it's in my book and it's in a little video I made that people can find on YouTube, but he's got the family crests of about a dozen or so relatives of his. And the reason he puts these there, of course, is that he's so full of himself that he wants people to know that he's plugged in and that his extended family are also very, very important people, right? All right, so that may sound like it has nothing at all to do with Shakespeare, but when you take a close look at these family crests on the outer perimeter of Tycho's engraving or selfie, you find two very familiar names, and those are the names Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. So that's really cool. Now, of course, you know, I didn't discover this. People have noticed this over the decades, although interestingly, it seems to be sort of discovered and then forgotten every 30 years or so. So I think this was first maybe noticed about 100 years ago, give or take, and then, you know, periodically it gets people's attention. So did Shakespeare know that Tycho had relatives named Rosencrantz and Guildenstern? Yeah, maybe. Maybe he saw the engraving. I mean, he lived in the same neighborhood in London as England's top astronomer, a man named Thomas Diggs. And in fact, now Diggs was a little bit older, and Diggs would die a few years before Shakespeare wrote Hamlet. But Thomas Diggs had two sons, and there's good reason to think that Shakespeare was chummy with at least one of Diggs' sons. And in fact, Thomas's son Leonard would go on to write a little poem praising Shakespeare, which is published in a very familiar place, the First Folio. It's the famous, very thick published collection of Shakespeare's plays with that very famous portrait of Shakespeare, the engraving by Martin Droschaut at the beginning. That's published in 1623 after Shakespeare is dead, but it's just quite interesting. It shows that Leonard Diggs was obviously a fan of Shakespeare. So you know, there's kind of something worth investigating here. There's something interesting going on. None of this proves that the play Hamlet was about the stars or about Copernicanism, but I think it's very interesting, and it's especially kind of intriguing to see, you know, to look at this engraving of Tycho Brahe and his extended family, and to get out your magnifying glass and go, hey, wait a minute, I know those two names. I know the name Rosencrantz and Guildenstern.
You're listening to Science for the People. We'll be back with more of Dan Falk and the science of Shakespeare right after this.
Science for the People is a weekly radio show exploring everyday life from a scientific perspective. To find out where Science for the People airs near you, or to listen to past episodes, check out our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. You'll also find links to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, or to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Science for the People. I'm Rochelle Saunders. I'm here with Dan Falk, talking about his book, The Science of Shakespeare, A New Look at the Playwright's Universe. A question that comes to mind is how much of the new science that was happening, so some of these sort of scientific revolution stuff that was going on at the time, would someone like Shakespeare have been aware of? Is it something that the common man on the street would be talking about or know about, or was it something that was reserved more for academics and aristocracy?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And as I mentioned a little earlier, you know, when we think about Copernicus's book, it was very mathematical. It's not something that ordinary people would have been very excited about. In fact, it's not something that ordinary people really would have been qualified to read. Although, for those who are interested in this, Owen Gingrich wrote a book a couple of years ago where he actually tracks down all the known copies of De Revolutionibus, that's Copernicus's book, and tries to figure out exactly who was exposed to it. But some discoveries were, I would say, caught people's attention more than others. And especially, now this comes a little bit later in Shakespeare's career, but especially the work of Galileo. This really did get people kind of excited. So Galileo had already sort of made a name for himself for other accomplishments. He was a bit of an inventor, and he was extremely good in mathematics, and he actually knew quite a lot about art and literature too, so he was able to lecture on a variety of topics. But in 1609, he got his hands on a new invention. He didn't invent the telescope. It was invented by some people in the Netherlands, perhaps by a few different glassmakers independently of each other. Hans Lepershey, if I'm pronouncing it right, is the one who often gets the credit for being first. But at any rate, sometime in 1609, this little, I want to call it a toy, because these are very simple optical devices compared to even the cheapest telescope you could buy today. So Galileo gets his hands on one of these optical toys and starts playing with it. And before long, he's improved on it. And he aims it at the night sky. He wasn't the only one. I mean, Galileo is the one who was the first to publish his findings. But there actually was a guy in England who has really been shortchanged by history. And that's Thomas Harriot. So Thomas Harriot was an English astronomer that I talk about a little bit in the book, who also looked at some of the same objects that Galileo looked at, and at around the same time. Okay, so Galileo is aiming his telescope at the night sky and seeing things that nobody knew existed. So he's seeing that the moon has this very irregular surface, very different from how it was described by the ancient Greeks. The sun isn't perfect either, because the sun actually has these spots on it, which we now call sunspots. Later, he would see that the planet Venus goes through phases like the moon does, and that's very interesting. And that immediately makes you question whether the Copernican system, rather than the ancient system of the Greeks, is the right one. So that comes a little bit, just a little bit later, but a very, very strong piece of evidence for that. He also looks at the Milky Way and finds that the band of light, this milky patch of light, is actually thousands and thousands of itty-bitty faint star. Well, of course, they're not actually small, but stars that are just so faint that you can't see them as individual stars unless you have a telescope. So Galileo is the first to make a note of that. And then what I think is really the kicker, very, very interesting discovery in the first few weeks of 1610, is that he looks at Jupiter, the brightest, well, actually Venus is equally bright, but Jupiter, the greatest of the planets, let's say, and he sees four little star-like objects. And he watches from night to night, and these little star-like objects seem to stay near Jupiter, and they're usually strung out in a kind of a line. So he eventually, they're associated somehow with Jupiter, and he comes to the conclusion that these are moons. Moons or satellites of Jupiter. And this is revolutionary because, according to the Greeks, everything goes around the Earth. I mean, there's only one center. You know, things go around the center, and the Earth is at the center, and that should be the end of the story. But here is Jupiter being its own center and having four little moons that go around it. So that's really interesting. He publishes a little book describing all of this. By now, it's the spring of 1610. It's called Sidereus Nuncius, or The Starry Messenger. So it's a little book. It's in Latin, but it's very easy Latin, I've been told. It's sort of schoolboy Latin, so anyone who had any sort of an education could read this book. And it had pictures. It had wonderful engravings showing these discoveries. So it really was the next best thing to having this pop up in your Facebook news feed, circa 1610, is that this little book was making the rounds. We know it was in England within days, I think, of its publication in Venice. But it became a bestseller. It was going around. And I think it's very likely that Shakespeare saw it. You know, maybe he heard about it first and hearing about it. I mean, here was a man very curious about the world. You know, we read biographies of Shakespeare, or we read Shakespeare's plays, which of course is the best thing you can do, and we see how interested he was in the human condition, which he was. But I think he was interested in everything. I think he was interested in, you know, man's place in nature, how things worked, how things were put together. And because this discovery of the moons of Jupiter occurs quite late, you know, Shakespeare only has a few more plays left to write. You know, The Tempest, A Winter's Tale, Cymbeline. So it's usually just imagined that he couldn't have had very much to say about it. So I try to set that right. And again, I'm just the journalist here, so this is based on the work of Scott Mezzano in particular, Peter Usher, who I mentioned before, John Pitcher at Oxford. So these are people who have taken a closer look at Cymbeline, one of Shakespeare's final plays. Cymbeline is, first of all, a largely overlooked play. The other two that I mentioned, The Tempest, is performed very often. Winter's Tale, not quite as popular, but still, you know, I was taking a Shakespeare course just a couple of years ago here in Toronto, and one of the required readings was Winter's Tale. But Cymbeline, a lot of people spend their whole life not reading or seeing Cymbeline. It really has been a bit overlooked. It's actually a pretty fun play. I won't try to do the whole plot summary, but it's very interesting. It's set in ancient Britain, and there's some issues with the Romans. The hero is this guy, Postumus Leonatus, who wants to marry the king's daughter. Well, there are a lot of complications, but at a certain point toward the end of the play, this fellow, our hero, Postumus, is in jail, and he has this sort of dream or vision in which the god Jupiter descends from the sky. Very, very dramatic. So the god Jupiter comes down, and then four ghosts dance in a circle around our hero. So people, just a few people, the researchers that I mentioned, have looked at this. And this is all amazing. This is all just within the last 10 years or so. I really don't think anyone thought about this previously. But this handful of researchers has looked at this and said, well, you know, you've got Jupiter. You've got four ghostly figures moving in a circle. Maybe this is an allusion to Galileo's discovery. And it's at the same time. Galileo's discovery is published early in 1610. The play, as far as we know, I mean, the records are a bit imperfect, but as far as we know, it was written that year, perhaps in the summer or fall of that year. So that's really striking. And this is one of the first things when I stumbled on this maybe 5 years ago, maybe a bit more, I thought, somebody has to investigate, or somebody at least has to round up what's been written on this topic. I thought it was very interesting. And so, again, I devote a whole chapter to this issue of the possible connections between Shakespeare and Galileo. Remember that I mentioned at the very beginning that we have this little point of trivia that Shakespeare and Galileo were born in the same year, and indeed they were. But here, you know, maybe, if you believe these interpretations, and I think they're at the very least quite interesting. You know, maybe there's a little bit more to connect Shakespeare and Galileo beyond just being born in the same year.
So just before we finish, I do want to touch on one other topic, which I found really fascinating. And that was the idea that Shakespeare incorporated some sort of modernly skeptical characters into some of his writing. And I'm thinking in particular of passages that are a bit skeptical of astrology, which was at the time an established sort of quote unquote reliable science.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because that's really one of my favorite things that, I mean, of course, Shakespeare scholars have been examining this, but I do wish it received more attention. And everybody knows the play King Lear, so I don't remember when I first, you know, became aware of Edmund's speech. This is Edmund's sort of a rant against astrology, and it comes just after his father has given a little speech about these late eclipses in the sun and moon, which in itself is interesting. So they're very conscious of celestial happenings, right? They know what's going on in the sky. And his father has said, these late eclipses portend no good for us. So, you know, clearly looking at it from the point of view of astrology, if there's something not quite right in the heavens, that means there's going to be trouble here on Earth. And that's Gloucester speaking, and Gloucester walks out of the room, and then Edmund is alone, and Edmund turns, I want to say to the camera, but I guess Edmund turns to the audience and does this little soliloquy. And this is where he goes on and says, oh, come on now. Do you really believe it matters, you know, which, you know, if I was born under the dragon's tail or which star was doing what? Shakespeare is much better with words than I am. But, you know, this is the excellent foppery of the world, that we blame our misfortunes on the stars when really we ought to take responsibility for our own actions.
This is the excellent foppery of the world, when we are sick in fortune, often the surfeit of our own behavior. We make guilty of our disasters the sun, the moon, and the stars, as if we were villains by necessity, fools by heavenly compulsion, knaves, thieves, and treacherous by spherical predominance, drunkards, liars, and adulterers by an enforced obedience of planetary influence, and all that we are evil in by a divine thrusting on. An admirable evasion of whore master man to lay his goatish disposition to the charge of a star.
And there are other passages like that. In Henry IV, Part 1, there's a really wonderful exchange between Hotspur and Glendower, where Glendower is saying, you know, when I was born, the heavens themselves shaked and rattled, right?
I cannot blame him. At my nativity, the front of heaven was full of fiery shapes, of burning crescents. And at my birth, the frame and huge foundation of the earth shaked like a coward.
And Hotspur is a skeptic, like Edmund, and he says, well, you know what? Sometimes those things happen, and it has nothing to do with you being born, you know? I mean, you can go around saying that if you want to, but even if your cat had only had kittens, those same events might have happened.
Why, so it would have done at the same season if your mother's cat had but kittened, though yourself had never been born.
Did Shakespeare share that skepticism? Well, we can't know, but I think these wonderful passages wouldn't be there unless Shakespeare had some measure of sympathy with the skeptical characters who speak them. So it's very interesting, and, you know, I joke around a little bit and say, well, was Shakespeare the, you know, the Carl Sagan of his time? Of course, that's, you know, that's silly. We can't go that far. But I think, you know, the world was changing, and within just a few generations, people began to see things very differently, and what we now think of as science, you know, becomes an actual thing, different from philosophy, different from religion, and the world becomes a very different place, and there's no turning back. But in Shakespeare's time, it was just this period of transition, and Shakespeare is writing his plays just on the cusp of this change to a new world. So it's just a very interesting time.
It really pleases me to think that there's a chance that Shakespeare might have been on the side of correlation is not causation argument.
yeah, exactly. Well said, because we hear that so much today. And I'm sure, you know, you can find this if you dig around the ancient Greeks. So it's not like this was a completely unknown idea, but that it's embedded right there in Shakespeare's plays gives me a warm feeling too, yes.
Dan, thanks so much for being here and sharing some of the stories from your book.
Well, it was my pleasure. I know I rambled on a bit, but I hope it was interesting.
You'll find a link to Dan Falk and the Science of Shakespeare on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. After the break, we'll talk about who actually wrote all those plays with Shakespearean scholar Stanley Wells. Stay tuned.
Science for the People is a weekly radio show exploring everyday life from a scientific perspective. To find out where Science for the People airs near you, or to listen to past episodes, check out our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. You'll also find links to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, or to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
You're listening to Science for the People with Rochelle Saunders. Today we're talking about Shakespeare, and we felt it would be terribly remiss if we didn't dive headlong into the authorship question. To help us make sense of the evidence is Stanley Wells, honorary president of the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust and a professor emeritus of Shakespeare Studies at the University of Birmingham. He is the honorary governor emeritus of the Royal Shakespeare Company and honorary fellow of Balliol College, Oxford. He is general editor of the Oxford and Penguin editions of Shakespeare and co-editor of the Oxford Companion to Shakespeare. His many books include Shakespeare for All Time, Shakespeare and Co., and Shakespeare, Sex and Love. He's also authored a Kindle single called Why Shakespeare Was Shakespeare and co-edited a collection of essays on authorship of Shakespeare titled Shakespeare Beyond Doubt. Stanley, thanks so much for being here.
It's a great pleasure to be with you.
So give us a little bit of background. When did Shakespeare's authorship first start to be questioned?
It starts in the middle of the 19th century in America. The first serious doubts came from a woman called Delia Bacon. An interesting lady. She was a talented woman. She was a teacher. She was a writer. She won a short story competition above Edgar Allan Poe. But unfortunately, she got interested in the authorship question. And she got ideas that somehow that the plays had been written by a committee, which included Francis Bacon, who was no relative of hers, in spite of the common name, and one or two other people. She didn't really work it out in any great detail, but she did publish, eventually, a very large book about it, which has the reputation of being an unreadable book, a highfalutin sort of philosophical tome. She came to England to try to pursue her theories, and she went first to St. Albans, which is where Francis Bacon, who became Earl of Eriel and Lord of St. Albans, where he lived. And then from there she came to Stratford. By then she was persuaded enough of her theories to ask the vicar of Stratford-on-Avon if she could open Shakespeare's grave. Not entirely easy to see why, except that she had some idea that there might be something in the grave that would prove her theories, like a little note, I suppose, saying it wasn't me, it was actually Francis Bacon or something like that. She went to the church, she got permission to go to the church with a mattock and spade one evening. She tried to summon up her courage to open the grave. She failed. And in the early hours of the morning, she went back to the lodgings not far from the church where she was staying. She died in a lunatic asylum a year or so later in America. After she'd done all this, however, she did sow enough of a seed for a Bacon Society to be started in America, and a few years later for one in England. And it was from those two societies that the movement against Shakespeare's authorship of the plays started to roll. And since then it has increased a very great deal. To such a degree, indeed, that in the meantime, over 70 different people have been suggested as the author of Shakespeare's plays, ranging from, well, including Christopher Marlowe. The current favourite is Edward de Vere, Earl of Oxford, 17th Earl of Oxford. Bacon has got lost in the running recently. But there have been some really absurd suggestions, like Queen Elizabeth I, for example, or Daniel Defoe, who died long after Shakespeare did. I think the very fact that so many different people have been suggested is in itself enough, surely, to make people raise their eyebrows, at least, about the whole thing. I mean, if there's no consensus on who it might have been the plays. But my own position, basically, about all this is that before deciding who did write them, you've got to disprove that Shakespeare wrote them. In my view, there is ample evidence that William Shakespeare of Stratford upon Avon wrote the plays and poems that he is credited with, along with a few collaborations. We're increasingly beginning to realize that, especially early and later in his career, he sometimes, as was very common indeed in the period, that he sometimes collaborated with other writers, especially John Fletcher, Thomas Middleton, and George Wilkins towards the end of his life. But basically, the 37 plays plus a few collaborations are the work of William Shakespeare of Stratford. I have no doubt about that.
So we're going to get into the evidence in just a second, but I'm curious. This is a debate that kind of keeps coming up. It refuses yes. to get sort of swatted down, no matter how much evidence there is for yes. William Shakespeare of Stratford-upon-Avon as the author. And I'm curious as to your thoughts of why this keeps coming up, why we keep talking about this.
It is an interesting intellectual and psychological phenomenon. The need that some people feel to question a person of enormously high reputation. It's as if somehow there's a sort of iconoclasm about it, which makes them desire to topple from his pedestal somebody who is so widely respected. One of the symptoms of it is sheer ignorance about Shakespeare's lifetime, I think, especially about the sort of education that was available in Stratford-upon-Avon in Shakespeare's time. So often people say things like, how could he have, instead of saying things like, how wonderful it is that he did. How could a man from Stratford-upon-Avon have written great immortal masterpieces? Well, why not, I have to say. Plenty of other people from humble backgrounds, like Ben Jonson, for example, who Shakespeare's great contemporary, whose father was a bricklayer. He wrote some of the greatest plays of the period, too. But that's really what it is, I think, that people are questioning, partly because they don't know enough, too, about the kind of education that was available in Shakespeare's time. It's unfortunate that we don't have the records of Stratford-upon-Avon Grammar School. We can't say from documentary evidence that Shakespeare went to that school, but then we can't say from documentary evidence that anybody went to the school until 1800, because the records of the school haven't survived. It was a free grammar school. John Shakespeare, Shakespeare's father, was the bailiff or the mayor of Stratford. He would have been entitled in any case to send his children to his sons, because girls, unfortunately, were not educated on the whole then, unless they were very high social status. John Shakespeare would have been entitled to send William to the grammar school, where he would have received exactly the education that people can see lying behind the plays. He would have had an education in the classics, a rather restricted but very intense education in the classics. Those are some of the reasons, then, why I think people... There's also a great deal of snobbishness involved. I think it's significant that many of the people who have been suggested are aristocrats, as if somehow you have to be of high social status to have written works of high intellectual and artistic status.
It's quite interesting, because if you look at the background and sort of origin stories of people like Christopher Marlowe and Ben Jonson, there's a similar background for those people as well. So how come their authorship hasn't been questioned?
Well, yes, that's an interesting, isn't it, that Shakespeare seems to be the only person whose authorship is questioned in the period. Marlowe, in fact, did go to a grammar school. We know that he went not only to a grammar school, but also to university. He went to the University of Cambridge. Shakespeare didn't go to university, neither did Ben Jonson.
You're listening to Science for the People, and today we're diving headfirst into the evidence behind Shakespeare as the author for those famous works that also bear his name. I'm here with Stanley Wells, Professor Emeritus of Shakespeare Studies at the University of Birmingham, who is walking us through the authorship debate. Okay, so let's talk about Shakespeare as the author, because I'm assuming right. There must be evidence for that.
There's masses of evidence, yes. In the first place, many of the works of Shakespeare were published with Shakespeare's name on them. For example, in 1593, the poem Venus and Adonis was published with a dedicatory epistle with, at the end of it, the words William Shakespeare, and he refers to that as the first heir of his invention. A year later, The Rape of Lucrece also appeared with the authorship of William Shakespeare proclaimed on its title page. Over the years, many plays were printed with Shakespeare's name on them. Not at first, because it wasn't always regarded as particularly important who wrote the play. A better selling point for some time was the company of actors that played it. So you might get a title page that says such and such a play as played by the Lord Chamberlain's men and so on. But from 1598 onwards, a number of plays are printed with the name William Shakespeare clearly upon them. The poems have that name. In 1609, Shakespeare's sonnets are printed with that as the title of the book. And then, of course, 7 years after Shakespeare dies, appears the First Folio, the collection of 36 plays published in 1623 with a prefatory epistle, a poem in praise of Shakespeare by Ben Jonson, with a number of other commendatory verses and poems in praise of Shakespeare, and with a portrait of Shakespeare, the Drusite engraving, and so there's lots of evidence that plays were written by somebody called William Shakespeare.
Now, a lot of people have pointed to a lack of document-based evidence about William Shakespeare's life in general. There's not a lot that survived, and some people point to this as a lack of evidence. I'm wondering, is that unusual for people of that time period? Is it unusual for playwrights from that time period?
No, it's not unusual. There are quite a lot of writers of the period we don't know very much about. We know quite a lot about Christopher Marlowe because he was a very colourful character. He was prosecuted for forgery, for example, for coining money illegally. There is a famous testament in which he says that all those that love not boys and tobacco are fools, documents about him. He was a colourful character. Shakespeare was not colourful in that way, but we know quite a lot about Shakespeare. The trouble is, the things we know about him are not the things we'd most like to know about him. We have his will, we have his baptism entry in the Stratford-upon-Avon church registers, we have the register of his marriage, we have the information about when his children were baptized, we have his will, which is in London, and above all, we have the monument in the church and the gravestone in the church. I say above all the monument because the monument says quite clearly that this is Shakespeare of Stratford-upon-Avon and has two epitaphs, one in English and one in Latin, both of them praising Shakespeare of Stratford-upon-Avon as a great writer.
Now, I'm assuming that people who were certainly Shakespeare's contemporaries and the people who were paying attention to him and watching his plays at the time would have talked about him, would have known him, perhaps.
Yes.
Is there any inkling from that time period or mention that perhaps he was not who he said he was?
No, none at all. Nothing at all. There are, for example, however, commendatory poems to Shakespeare. Several poets wrote poems about Shakespeare, praising him. And there are references to him in a play, a Cambridge play, three plays actually, called the Parnassus Plays, which refer to Shakespeare as a writer. Rather jokingly, they're very amusing plays. There's an anecdote about him from 1601, a rather rude anecdote about him pursuing a citizen's wife after a performance of the play, suggesting that the writer of that anecdote thought he was a rather amorous character. So there's a lot about him. But there are gaps, of course, certainly, but there are gaps in the records of anybody from that period. The people who are most likely to leave records behind in that period are the aristocrats, because they had the muniment rooms in their houses, in the great houses, and their documents about their lives would have been preserved. It's a matter of chance whether the documents about what you might call ordinary people, which includes the extraordinary people who were extraordinary writers, about what survives about them.
So, by contrast, is there any similar evidence or types of evidence available for anyone else as an author? You mentioned that some people are proposed as other authors are aristocrats. So, was there anything found in their piles of documents that would indicate that they may have written these works?
No. That's one of the interesting phenomena. I mean, if you're talking about the Earl of Oxford, for example, we know a lot about the Earl of Oxford, and a lot of it is highly unsavory. He's a very nasty man. There's a very good biography of him. Lots of records survive about him, about his travels. He went to Venice. He brought a choir boy back from Venice with him. He had a wife and children. He was involved in diplomatic business at the time. We know a great deal about him, but as you suggest, there's nothing whatever in all the voluminous papers about him to suggest that he wrote the plays attributed to William Shakespeare. There's actually a book, a printed book of 1598, in which he is referred to as a writer. He was a minor poet. He and Shakespeare are referred to in the same sentence, which shows that the author of that book, Francis Mears, knew that they were two different people. And yet people go on, a lot of people go on and on, including a recent film, fairly recent film called Anonymous, directed by Roland Emmerich, which had this as the whole basis of the film.
So what evidence are the people who dispute Shakespearean authorship actually pointing to?
Well, about 2,000 people have signed an online statement called the Declaration of Reasonable Doubt. And they include people who have various ideas about who might have written Shakespeare. They point to the fact that there are no documents from before Shakespeare died which link Shakespeare with Stratford-upon-Avon. However, I mentioned the memorial in the church. The church memorial here, quite clearly, is to William Shakespeare, and it has two epitaphs on it, one in Latin, one in English, identifying the William Shakespeare of Stratford-upon-Avon as a great writer. The poems in front of the first folio, including Ben Jonson's great poem in praise of Shakespeare, it's a very fine poem, refers to Shakespeare as the Sweet Swan of Avon. Another poem in that volume refers to his Stratford monument. There is another poem, not included in that volume, by a man called William Bass, of which we've traced at least 36 or 37 different manuscripts in the period, some of which are headed William Shakespeare, the poet who died at Stratford-upon-Avon in 1616 and so on. So there is plenty of evidence to link Shakespeare of Stratford, to identify him as the author of the plays and the poems. If you make that proviso that it has to be evidence from his lifetime, it's true that that doesn't exist. But then, you know, if you don't accept posthumous evidence, you'd never believe that anybody had ever died.
So are there any Shakespearean academics, serious Shakespearean academics, that think it's possible or maybe likely that the plays were authored by somebody else?
Not that I've ever met, no, and I've met most of them.
That seems fairly reasonable. I've read a couple of these theories. Obviously, 80 different proposed authors would be a lot to wade through. But the ones that I've read, they do seem to have a bit of a conspiracy aura to them that includes something about government destroying certain documents or that perhaps someone's death was faked in the case of Christopher Marlowe being put forth as an author.
Yeah, that's a particularly ridiculous one. And yet there are quite a few people who adhere to it, but the record of Christopher Marlowe's death is absolutely clear. We have the records of the inquest, we have the records of his burial, and indeed in one of Shakespeare's plays he's referred to as being dead. In As You Like It, one of the characters in the play, Celia, quotes a line from Marlowe's great poem Hero and Leander, and refers to its author as Dead Shepherd. Shepherd there meaning a pastoral poet. So if you believe that Marlowe wrote Shakespeare, you have to believe that Marlowe himself, in As You Like It, wrote about himself as being dead.
That's awesome. Stanley, thanks for joining us today.
Okay.
If you want to learn more about Stanley Wells, we've linked to him on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. While you're there, click the links to leave a comment on the episode, connect with us on social media, or subscribe to the weekly podcast. Special thanks as well to John Earl Robinson of the Repertory Theater of Iowa for lending his voice to the words of the Bard. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Science for the People.
Science for the People is recorded in Edmonton, Alberta. The show is produced by Rochelle Saunders. Ryan Bromsgrove is our promotions manager. Our social media manager is Chelsea Butler. K.O. Myers updates our website. Helen Quivillon is our publishing liaison. Ed Haynes is our guest coordinator. We get research help from Josh Witten. The show is edited by K.O. Myers and Ryan Bromsgrove. Our theme song was written and recorded by Fractal Pattern, and its title is Binary Consequence. The show is hosted by Rochelle Saunders, Marie-Claire Shanahan, and me, Desiree Shell.